Giovanni, Shiloh, and Manisha.
Welcome, everyone, to Fortress on the Hill, a podcast about U.S. foreign policy, anti-imperialism, skepticism, and the American World War. I'm Giovanni. Thank you for being with us today. Most Americans will remember the war happening in Eastern Europe starting on February 24, 2022, when Russian President Vladimir Putin announced special military operations and the intervention in Ukraine. Back then, there was an uproar in Western society, and Western media went into hysteria. Huge condemnations from NATO countries and their close allies. It was described as a grievous of crimes, the worst. This was naked Russian aggression not seen in Europe since the Second World War. Forgetting that two decades earlier, NATO set the former Yugoslavia on fire, causing the dismemberment of the country, and that they themselves have been waging war and bombing multiple Muslim-majority countries for the last two decades. There was a new Hitler in Europe, and his name was Vladimir Putin, was the Western outcry. All of a sudden, everything Russian was canceled in the West. Russophobia was at its highest. Now, if you remember the war starting 2 years ago, that's because the U.S. and Western media, let's call it the NATO media, has been sure to keep you thinking this war started 2 years ago out of a vacuum with no context. The way the media constructed the narrative is that Ukraine was minding its own business in peace when Putin all of a sudden decided to invade just for funsies. Most Americans would be unaware that Kyiv had already been at war for the last 9 years against its Russian-speaking population in the eastern region called the Donbass and against other Ukro-Russian inhabitants in the area. The catalyst for this war was the CIA-NATO 2014 engineered coup in Kyiv, which used the Euromaidan protest as a cover to facilitate the seizure of power by ultra-right-wing and neo-Nazi elements and militias such as the Right Sector and other banderite factions of the Ukrainian government. Here to tell us more, I'm honored to introduce our guest. All the way from Moscow is Olesya Orlenko. Olesya is a Russian historian, researcher, and reporter. She studied at the Institute of Russian and Archive in Russia, History Archive of Russia, and at the National Charter School in France. Her interests include World War II, Nazi genocide and extermination policy, history of the far right movement, and theories in France. Since 2014, Olesya has been closely following events in the Donbass province and has traveled to the war zone several times to gather facts of crimes committed by the Ukrainian army against the inhabitants of Donetsk and Lugansk regions. She became a journalist in 2016 and has been reporting on such facts since. Olesya is an author, documentarian, and founder of the Russian Society of France of Les Humanités, a French left-wing newspaper. Welcome to the show, Olesya.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Olesya, please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and what brought you to your interest.
Firstly, as you have already mentioned, I was working as a historian. And I think I'm telling this story all the time when I'm speaking about the Donbass, the events that happens now. For me, they are directly related with my historian, with my interest, with my occupation as historian. I was working in different historical research projects, and one of them, which was very interesting, lasted many years. I was collecting the memories. I was recording the eyewitnesses of Nazi genocide in Soviet Russia, Soviet Belarus, Soviet Latvia, people who are still even there. It was the special area of Nazi extermination policy where many villages were entirely destroyed and the population killed or sent to the concentration camps. And as it was 2010, 2011, so it was quite a long time ago, we could still find those who were children at the time of World War II, people who had 10 years, 9 years at this time. And we made quite interesting work with a lot of recordings, many thousands of interviews. Of course, I wasn't alone. I was with my colleagues, and we are spending all summer actually in those area by traveling village to village. So very interesting work, very rich and very important, I think. When in 2014, all these those Maidan story and the war in Donbass began, I recognized when I was following the news and when I was speaking with the people who lives, the people I know who lives in Donetsk, what they were talking, how they were describing what happens, I really recognized that I've had a really deja vu feeling. I heard this before from different persons and about different time, but for me, it was so obviously that history repeated. And I started to do the same thing that I done some years ago. I started to record the information about what happens. So we're making a list of facts. And me and some colleagues of mine, we started doing this work. Well, it was like just for ourselves. It wasn't the institution or something. So we just started to make this. And then we created the Facebook page, but of course it's not official organization, just a Facebook page for fix and to make reposts of some news. Well, disappeared. They're passing away all the time. And actually in 2014, we were hoping that it will stop, that we haven't had an idea that it will last for years, all this war and this confrontation. We decided to proceed with our work. We started to find other people who could help us. We started to find other people in Donetsk. As I told you, I've been in Donetsk in Soviet time as a child, and I know people there from there. I know people who are at the age of my parents, and they had their children as well. Some of them evacuated it just at the beginning of the war because it was very violent. But some of them stayed there, so I could really get the information directly from the place. And as everything evaluated in the bad sense of this word, I'm still there. I'm still doing this kind of job. I'm still doing this kind of work. But of course, we now have our team, because since 2014, some of my colleagues went away because by specific occupation. And actually, those events bring me to the, because I wanted to find the journalists from the other country who share my views, my opinions. And I found them actually. 2016, I found them. And I was optimist at the time. I was optimist. I thought that really sort of mobilization, social activist mobilization would really contribute to change things to better. But unfortunately, it wasn't. And now, after the beginning of special operation, I'm going myself to the place. And even it's a special operation. I was in Donetsk when special operation began. I was with the French journalist there. Of course, I didn't know that everything going to happen, but I've seen how it was. I came there in Donetsk to follow the mobilization, because if you remember, in the beginning of February, there was a big mobilization and at the same evacuation of civilians, because all this tension in the border on the front line, it was violated, the front line and the agreement of stop fire. I don't know how to say it, but it was violated many times. So I think it was in the air that something will happen. And because of that, the ceasefires, it was violated, and it was in the air that something will happen. But of course, we didn't expect to be in the middle of all those events. Since then, I came several times in Donetsk. But what I insist in my work is always to record the civilians. I'm not covering the war events, and I'm not covering the military issues. What I'm doing is I'm always coming to people who are always victims, actually, all the time. And from both sides, victims are civilians. And I'm talking with them. And that's what I'm doing. I'm standing always at the same position as I was in 2014. So from this point of view, my views didn't change. So I'm always thinking what I thought 10 years. And it's horrible. It sounds horrible. That's what I continue to do, even when everything will stop. Because the crimes against civilians is always very vulnerable topic. And one of the most important for society. All the time, no matter how much time spent passed from there. The truth is that even now, the events of Second World War are still harmful for some people, for historical memory, for social memory. And I can say the same thing from no matter which country.
So you said you chronicle and what the civilians has been experiencing. And you write about that and you discuss and you talked about the civilians. And you got there in 2014 and you've been to Donetsk and Luhansk area since the special military operation. Can you describe what the civilians were telling you back then and what they're telling you now? If anything has changed, if it's the same, if it's gotten better?
Well, it's actually, yes, they have changed their views, of course. But I mean, I'll explain you why I'm saying this. I think that everybody now in media and it's very present is this rhetoric that Eastern Ukraine is pro-Russian. It's more Russian speakers and the area with a special history connected very much with Russia since centuries, and the Western Ukrainian and contrary is like, you know, more the language is more similar with Polish language and the territory were in Poland during many years. I can tell you that Donetsk, well, and my opinion, as I remember this in Soviet time, and as I know it now, perhaps I'm wrong, but I'm telling you my view of this region. It's absolutely a double-speaking region. Even between my friends, I can tell you that even they speak Russian in bilingual. Yeah, they are bilingual, and if they speak Russian in their family, they are absolutely capable to speak Ukrainian. I can tell you more. I can tell you that some of my friends and my comrades came in Donetsk or in the region, in these families came there, living there since 19th century. They were learning at Ukrainian schools, but they speak perfectly Russian without any accent, you know? So a lot of people there are bilingual. And I'm not saying, of course, it's even in the cities, and I'm not saying in villages, because if you come in village, of course, you will hear all this mix of Russian, Ukrainian, and very, very different languages and special vocabulary which you cannot find anywhere else. So it's very, very interesting from this point of view, from sociological and ethnological point of view. But this confrontation, so I cannot say tell you that in 2014, and people, and I'm asking them why they, for example, were in anti-Maidan in 2014 in Donetsk. They won't tell you that we don't want to be in Ukraine or we don't want to speak Ukrainian. No, they are speaking Ukrainian. The problem is the issue is always political choice. As people understand, because you know the political choice is when you say this, you should understand that the political who will sign the agreements or who will talk with the leaders of other country, and the person who lives in Donetsk going to work at the I don't know, at the factory or no matter, or who lives in the village. They have the different understanding of this political choice, how it was explained to these people, because that's always the matter of the state. Keep the country together, you really need to make all citizens to understand that they are citizens of this country. And I think that 2014, it's a big failure of the Ukrainian state. I mean, this failure didn't occur in 2004 because it's the consequence of the previous evolution. But in 2014, it was the sign that the Ukrainian state made a big mistakes before, and it's not capable to keep the country together. If you hear what people were saying in 2014, the problem is not what it was thinking about the Kyiv war, about the government. But when people saw that there is an army, people from Donetsk, or I don't know, in Slavyansk, for example, that people from Slavyansk, well, they saw that the army, the citizens of the same country, they speak in the same language, when they come to shoot them, when the first blood started to appear and the civil war was operated in Kyiv, because Kyiv made a choice to keep the country together, the government made a choice to start the civil war. So this choice made a really split between Ukraine and people from Donbas and Lugansk and Donetsk areas, territories. They started, the split started there, from the civil war. And 2014, I really heard voices that we need to stop it, we need to stop fire, we need really to find another solution. In 22, when I came there, the discourse has absolutely changed. In this case, the discourse of people, when you go to the magazine, to the street, and you stop people, when I talk to them, they are saying that I don't want to be. And many friends of mine says that Ukraine killed Ukrainian in me. So I don't want, I cannot be in this state. So their political choice were determined by policy of Kyiv. That's what they say. That's why when it was the referendum, our colleagues are followed really very much this referendum. I think this referendum about the self-determination and about to enter in Russian, in September of 2022, I think it was really fair. Maybe it sounds for those who listen to us unacceptable, but it's really fair because I met all the time. I haven't ever met in my displacement in Lugansk, in Donetsk. I haven't ever met someone who can say that, no, I don't agree. I don't want to be in Russia. So all of them were dreaming about Russian because they had their reason. People was thinking that it will resolve the problem and they help them in their situation. They were during 8 years in a very in a humanitarian catastrophe, and of course, only solution they seen the Russian choice. So I think that instead of resolving the problem, the Ukrainian government chose to make things worse, and as well the big failure of the Ukraine. Many people I know in 2014-15, they were trying to leave the area of Kumbets, and they wanted to evacuate it somewhere. And many of them chose Ukraine. They moved to Ukraine, I mean to the central or east Ukraine, or to avoid the danger. And they came back because they were accepted with they didn't feel themselves as in their country. They felt better in Crimea or in Rostov region or in Russia. Many of them left the central and eastern Ukraine and moved back in the east. Of course, there are people who evacuated and who made the choice to stay in Ukraine. I'll keep in contact with some of them. And I'm keeping contacts with my Ukrainian friends and comrades who are still in Ukraine, but their situation is very complicated. Some of them stayed in Ukraine because they couldn't leave. Now they are hiding from the mobilization. Anyway, the situation is very hard, as they describe it. And some of my friends are now in Ukrainian prisons, and with some of them we really can hardly communicate because 2 years now they are in prison.
So know that and 2014 after the coup, the anti-Russian sentiments, right, really intensified in Western Ukraine. You start seeing attacks against the Russian identity in Ukraine. You start seeing people, politicians, political parties being canceled or prohibited because they were thought to be close to Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church was shut down. There were banned on books on Russian language. You saw trade unions in Odessa, for example, they barricaded themselves in their office building, and a mob, an anti-Russian mob, pretty much set the building on fire and killing all 80 of them. Crimea rapidly conducted a referendum with the majority voting to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. Russia conceded and annexed the peninsula. The people of Donbass did the same. However, Russia did not annex them. What do you think that happened?
Those anti-Russian sentiments in Western Ukraine, you know, I've faced them even when I was a child. It's not something that appeared 10 years ago. I was born in 1981, and my family was half Ukrainian. And you can see my name in my family name are Ukrainians, and my grandfather was from the Western Ukraine. And so I can tell you that he was born in Poland, because it was at the moment when he was born, it was Polish territory. And I can tell you that in this part of my family, the nationalism was very strong. In Soviet time, especially in Moscow, you know, and she was military. And it wasn't exposed too much, you know. It wasn't the topic of family conversation. But I really, I do remember the anti-Semitic speech, the phrases. I didn't make any attention to that, but I remember that it was really the reason of the confrontation with my mother and father sometimes. Although they were young as well. So what I'm saying, that people like the extremists, the nationalists, the radicals, they are existing in all country and all the time. How influenced they become in the country. So it's like a criminal. So they can say is that in everywhere where there is a human society, there are deviations and there will be criminals or, I don't know, sick people. But if you, the question is, if you allow them to make decisions, if you allow them to influence the others, I'm not thinking that West Ukraine is completely anti-Russian. They're only racist who lives there, and now it's not. I was in Lviv. I was in Western Ukraine, and I've seen, of course, I've seen both. I've seen the racist, even. But at the same time, I've seen very intelligent, smart people. And I don't know how they're living now, because they are afraid to contact someone in Russia. It was since the beginning of the war, since 2014, they stopped contact with me. The problem is the minority, this radical minority. They are now access there to education, they can influence the society. They have all freedom to express their ideas. The opportunities to express the opposite opinion are very, very, very wide. It's not natural conflict. There were a lot of opportunities to avoid this conflict, to resolve it then. And even when the special operation began, there was still time while people from the society, the international community could really introduce and influence or to stop the violence. But we are observing, I'm observing since 2014, even earlier, but let's take for 2014, when the one opportunity after another is lost. When one red line crossed, another one extended and then crossed again. So now I can, now the reality, I remember that 2 years ago, I was reading the articles and the political say it was saying from France, from US, from was saying that no, this is a red line, we couldn't cross it. But now, look, 2 years have passed and we've seen that all red lines of 2 years ago, now they are passed away. And what else? What we're doing? Where we're doing again? So is there any real red line which we cannot cross? We're talking about the Crimea, it was very interesting particular region, but it was very, from strategical point of view, very, very important for Russia. I think that this conflict, when I'm talking about the Ukraine, but of course, the relations in the post-Soviet states depended as well from Russia. And for Russia, it is the failure as well since the collapse of the Soviet Union. One failure for after another for Russia. Everything started from the war. It's just, if you see Sochi, and it's just very, very near to Sochi. You take 2 hours maximal for to go there by train. And I visited Abkhazia as a journalist as well. I've seen it's really a disaster. It's a disaster. It's a absolutely abandoned, very, very rich region. But I've seen those, the entire city, the ghost city, you know, well, the entire city, you could see the buildings, but you can also see the traces of the war ended 30 years ago. You still can see the faces of fires, of destroyed buildings, and the city, a whole city is abandoned. It's hallucinating. It's amazing. I mean, in the bad sense of this word. Even there, I've seen that about 9 or 10 persons still live there. Of course, the old one. I really, of course, Abkhazia, it wasn't the first war, but I mean, for the first war for after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then you can see two wars in Chechnya. It was really a civil war caused by the policy of Russia, but as well because of the failure of, or political failure of Russia, political failure of government. Actually, that's why I don't know if I'm discovering something for your audience, but one of the reasons of popularity of Putin, because he came and he was the only person who could stop this conflict in Chechnya. And it was his first political success, and it was really brought him really a lot of electoral voices and a lot of popularity in Russia, because before we were thinking that this war is unstoppable, it's impossible to stop. As they are telling now about the war in Ukraine, you know, I was in Chechnya just a small visit of 3 days. I've seen Grozny. I remember because I was learning at the school and then at university. I remember after the bombing, it was like the city was almost completely razed, Grozny. But now if you go there, you cannot find any traces of the war. It's absolutely new, but you come there, you won't say how it looked like.
You mentioned about Chechnya and people thinking that Chechnya was going to be an indefinite war that will never end. Is that the sentiment in Russia right now with the Ukrainian war that it would never end?
Well, not in Russia. I think that in Russia, the perception of what happens of special operation is, as a perception of what happens in Donetsk, it's absolutely different. It's quite different in Donetsk and in Moscow. When you are in Moscow, you really you will see the city, or beautiful city, people living There are a lot of distractions, going to restaurants, celebrating, etc., etc. Of course, in Donetsk, it's different. And that's why when people from Donetsk come in Moscow, they say that we have an impression that we are, well, that it's really, that it's not real what happens there back home. But, you know, of course, there is a sort of depression in many regions of Donetsk. To look at the future, people need the stability. And when, for example, Donetsk, the bombing of Donetsk never stopped since 2014. Never stopped. Every day. I mean, of course, the damage was different, but every day they were bombing Donetsk. Not a single day stopped. That's why, for example, in the city, they don't construct new buildings, new apartments, or because they could be destroyed. Nobody wants to start the construction there. But, for example, in Mariupol, I was in Mariupol when it was just when the Ukrainians went away. I was there when still Azovstal were fighting. It was just the moment where it was coming to the end, but I've seen the city, I've seen this road, I've seen everything that could be in the city, in the state. And when I came my last time and I came there, it has changed. Even if there are a lot of buildings destroyed and you can still see the traces of destruction, but still see the changes. And I can tell you that it influenced the population. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that people forgot everything and now they are happy there. And of course, this period was very, it's a real catastrophe. When people see the changes for better, it's really interesting. But in Donetsk, for example, they don't see these changes. I mean, they see a lot of changes, political changes, I mean. And of course, the situation changed in the matter of that the now they can earn money, they can work and get their salary, they can get the payment for retreatment, for the pension, or the infrastructure started to work. So it's a reality. But still, for them, of course, the changement will be when the violence and the combats stop. And that is what they're waiting for. And can tell you that a lot of them are really tired of this situation, because 10 years, imagine 10 years in this situation.
Well, hopefully ends soon. Recently here in the United States, like I mentioned earlier, the years prior to 2022 didn't exist, right? Everything happened in a vacuum. Since 2022, Washington has poured billions, hundreds of billions of dollars into this war. The European Union, Germany, etc., right, to keep it going. Recently, there's a bill going on right now that Democrats here wants to push. Political division here in the United States with the Republicans wanting to defund the war in Ukraine, and they'd rather fund more the war in Israel. They'd rather fund conflict with China and Taiwan. They'd rather fund those, but they want to defund the war in Ukraine, whereas the Democrat wants to continue funding it. So there's this fight in Congress right now. But it's still, the media is still presenting this conflict as a Ukrainian-Russian war. The West has nothing to do with it. They give life to it because of the funding and the billions of weapons, you know, dollars of weapons that goes into this war. Do Russians see it the same way? They see it as just a Ukrainian-Russian war?
Oh, no, of course not. Of course not. In Russia, this conflict is viewed as a war of Western countries. And I can tell you, even in Russia, there is a tendency to see the Ukraine as a victim. I mean, Ukrainians, not the Ukraine as the government, but the Ukrainian people to viewed in Russia as a victim of the policy, Western policy, United States, of course. And of course, this view is presented the idea to simplify things. Of course, you cannot design one as a bad person, bad actor, and another as a good actor. Of course, all those conflicts, and I mean, not only Russian and Ukrainian, but I mean, a lot of wars that exist now in the modern world is because the diplomatic and political solution of problem could not be found. And it can't be found because of the incompetence of political establishment. I think that, of course, Western countries are, it's not far from call them the direct actors of the conflict, because it's not only the matter of money, financial support of this military escalation and combats, but the arms that they deliver to the Ukraine, the arms that can attack Russia with these arms. So it's but Russia, of course, Russia may as well prevent as well this red line extended from the Russian part as well. But I think we are very close to the direct implementation in this conflict of Western countries. In any way, now, even I see some of voices from one of our European countries saying that Ukraine will lose the war, Putin can win, etc., etc. But all this, they are saying this not to stop with the conflict, but to prepare for a bigger one. And we can see in Germany, in France, the rhetoric is political. Now they are, I'm starting to hear it, that you really should prepare to the attack from the Russia. But, and we should restore the, for example, in France, very big problem. The police and the army, the status of military men and the army is not very high in French society. And now Macron says that we need to restore for teenagers, we need to restore the prestige of our army. So they are starting to talk about that. And at the same time, they're saying that Russia is going to invade Europe. As a historian, I can recognize absolutely not the cliches, even the phrases, the whole phrases. They were used even in 16th century when Russia firstly appeared in European field, in European view, and the old cliché, they're coming from that at that time. So why I'm saying this, I want to tell you, to stop this conflict, you really should have an intention to stop with the escalation. But for that, all actors and Europeans and the U.S. the USA government, they should absolutely change the rhetoric, you know, of the policy. Like when I was planning, I was talking about my French friend. And he asked me, well, how can you, what you're proposing now, but now, February of 2024, for to stop or for to resolve the problem? And I was saying that it was really very hard. It was hard 2 years ago, but 2 years ago, it was still possible. But now, I mean, it's harder than 2 years ago, but still, I think still possible. But for that, you really should accept part of responsibility for what happened. So USA and France, for example, should stop denying that they are in conflict. Firstly, then they should accept and recognize that they are contributed a lot for the stabilization of the situation in post-Soviet Union and Ukraine, etc. The same for USA, of course. So they should really stop and really go from there and really to the NATO should go from this area completely, and other actors to introduce the an independent to introduce and to control the situation, like for example Cuba or Venezuela. But do France or United States will they ever accept that Cuba will contribute to resolve this conflict? No, of course not, because for that, the United States should really change their position towards Cuba. But if the United States, for example, changed the position towards Cuba, perhaps it will move. And the problem is that it's not the only the conflict in Ukraine what matters, but now this conflict in Israel and Gaza. It's different conflict, but it comes in the same situation of destabilization and of denial. It is the failure of international law. The international justice is the only way to resolve no matter which conflict. The international justice doesn't work in one case. It means that it doesn't work. I mean, not a mistake, but the international justice has no right to be selective, not once, because to be selective once, it means to be selective every time. So it should be the same for everybody, no matter of political ideology, no matter, it should be the same for North Korea, for Cuba, for United States, for Russia, for Ukraine, and for France. I think the only way.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is a good place for us to wrap it up. Alessia, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your time, thoughts and experiences on this. Any last comment before we part?
No, thanks a lot. Thank you for your patience.
What do you recommend to our audience to learn more about the situation, and what resources do you recommend?
I think that it's very important to get the information from different resources, from different points of view. When you have a conflict and when you have people and media who cover this conflict, there's always a tendency to take a part. And of course, there are a lot of medias and or bloggers or journalists who are taking part, or Russian part, Donetsk part. And I can tell you that I'm taking part as well. I am always on the side of civilian population. And I was there, I was standing there, and I'm always looking from the point of view of a simple person, not a military one, it's always a victim. But you really, what I can really advise to your audience is not to be afraid of a media qualified as pro-Russian one. So even if you think that this is Kremlin propaganda, take your time to read what they are reading. Take your time to analyze and compare the information from other sources. And I mean, not with the aim to say, I will find something for to put look the arguments against what you're saying. No, try to understand why people writing this. Don't be like, you know, like in France, for example, they forbade the Russian channels, information channel. And France, the country of the freedom of speech, and you can see that they are abiding the presence of Russian channels. I'm not trying to defend, for example, Russia Today now. But I can tell you, for example, in the French example, that one, it was the Yellow Jackets, yeah? It's movement, the protest movements in France. The Russia Today was the only media who didn't call those people terrorists, bandits, lazy or wokists. That's why they were really followed by French people. I think you really should not be afraid of cliché, and to make your own opinion, to listen to the information and not influenced by the qualification they given to the source of this. Just try to think yourself. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With that, yes, thank you again for joining us. And let's hope together that this conflict comes to an end soon. Take care.
Money is tight these days for everyone. Penny pinching to make it through the month often doesn't give people the funds to contribute to a creator they support. So we consider it the highest honor that folks help us fund the podcast in any dollar amount they're able. Patreons is the main place to do that. In addition, any support we receive makes sure we can continue to provide our main episodes free for everyone. And for supporters who can donate $10 a month or more, they will be listed right here as an honorary producer, like these fine folks. Fahim's Everyone Dream, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Janet Hansen, Ren Jacob, Scott Spaulding, Spooky Tooth, and Helgeberg. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can contribute directly through PayPal at paypal.me/fortressonahill. Or please check out our store on Spreadshirt for some great Fortress merch. We're on Twitter and facebook.com/fortressonahill. You can find our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.